Hello again and welcome. Today, we find ourselves once again in America, where anything can happen. From your dreams coming true, to your nightmares becoming real. I am your host, Patrick Michael, and this is American Crimes. Welcome. Hello again, what's going on everybody? Glad to have you back, so pumped to be here. I just want to first off say thank you to everybody who has enjoyed the last several episodes. You know, I'm really having a great time doing this podcast just for the simple fact that I'm seeing that you guys are enjoying it as well. So thanks again for listening. Hope you enjoyed the Brooklyn, New York episode. It was nice to get away from Indiana and Texas, which we that's one of the things I didn't want to do the same state multiple times, but incidentally that's kind of how it went. But yeah, we ended up in Brooklyn in the last episode, and it's a dark tale for sure. Don't forget, you can follow the show now on social media at Crimes American on Twitter, and you can follow me on social media on Instagram at Patrick Michael Comedy. And, you know, I love interaction with the audience, so please do that. But, you know, we're going to get right into this, man. I'm excited. I'm ready to do it. Let's jump right into it. Today's a very interesting one because I find myself curious about these guys and the things that they do, and their crimes are always the most peculiar for the simple fact that it's in sequence. They tend to find a way of committing these crimes, and they do it multiple times. So I find that that makes the most interesting story for this show. So that's what we're going to try and stick with here. And we have a good one today because this is the largest serial killer or killer, I would imagine, probably in history. Probably not forever, not that far back, but definitely as of recent history. The man is still alive. He is still incarcerated. We're going to get into all that right now. But before we do that, we have to talk about Burbank, California, and what it was like in Burbank around these times when this criminal roamed the streets. All right, guys, so we're definitely taking a trip from Brooklyn, New York, all the way to the West Coast now. We're all the way out in Brooklyn here. Never been. I only hear good things, as it seems to. Not Brooklyn. We're not in Brooklyn anymore. We have left Brooklyn. We are in Burbank, excuse me. And I feel like I've only heard good things. There has been definitely some negative things, but there's also been a lot more positive. I feel like when I hear Burbank, I think news stations, news anchors, the news in general. I don't think it's just me either. I think you guys probably feel the same way, especially if you're from the Midwest or even the East Coast. And I've never heard of anything other than there's probably news stations. Burbank, California sounds like a place where Burbank, California, WNYC. Damn it. See, I'm mixing them up again. You like that? Ridiculous. I'll be honest, though. I would definitely check this place out if I was ever to be in California. Outside of Hollywood, of course, Burbank is actually a city in Los Angeles. This is just some few random facts about Burbank before I get into the population as well as the crime rate around this time. But it's a metropolitan area of Southern California. It's billed as the media capital of the world. So there you go. That's where I had made that connection. And only a few miles northeast of Hollywood, so numerous media and entertainment companies are headquartered, or significant production facilities are in Burbank, including Warner Brothers, the Walt Disney Company. See, I fucked up. Feel like I should have known this stuff before I had said anything. But yes, this is a huge, huge city. A lot of, as you can see, a lot of media, a lot of famous people in and out, coming in and out, living around the area. It just makes this case even stranger, because back then Warner Brothers was even still a thing. So who knows the other people that would have possibly came across this man and ultimately become victims at a certain point. But continuing on about Burbank, the crime rate now, as far as a number of crimes, as violent, there is 257 property. There's 2,962. And in total, there's 3,219. So the crime rate as far per 1,000 residents, 2.45 for violent, 28.25 property, and 30.71 in total. And as far as a general ranking, 100 being the safest, it is ranked 16 as far as neighborhoodscout.com. It's safer, though, than 16% of U.S. cities. Doesn't sound like a good number at all. Doesn't sound good, but maybe that's just me. Maybe it's just me. Maybe you guys think that does sound pretty good. Maybe you're interested in moving to California, and specifically Burbank. I wonder what the housing is like out there. Like, is it cheap? I really doubt it. I doubt it. There's mentions of, like, Johnny Carson being around this area. People like that. I mean, he's obviously not still alive, but you get what I'm saying. That level of fame, that level of celebrity living in this area, I can't imagine the housing is going to be cheap at all, if there's housing. The population of Burbank, as currently as 2016, 104,447, what? There's 104,447 people as far as 2016. That seems awfully, awfully low. But I guess then again, it is not very big. And like I said, the housing, probably dismal. Probably not a lot. Just because it is a smaller area. Not a lot of miles. You know, not a huge place. Yeah, see, as far as 2017, there's 104,000, so even less people. That's bizarre to me. I don't know, I just assumed that there'd be a lot more people. So it is a smaller town. Smaller city. It's definitely a little, I would say. It's just, in comparison to what we've done so far, the town did grow steadily, though, weathering the drought and depression that hit Los Angeles between the 1890s. In the 1890s, excuse me. And in the 20 years, the community had a bank, newspaper, high school, and a thriving business district with a hardware store. So you can imagine, things were popping off, doing well in this area for a long time. But it is very small. But it seems like the weather has to be perfect. It feels like where they would shoot many television shows. And it seems like that's what we're getting into right here. But the man that we're going to be talking about, the crimes that we're going to be talking about, have nothing to do with this at all. It only has to do with the location. It has nothing to do with famous faces or famous people at all. But it is kind of crazy that this guy lived in that area. And we're going to talk about him right after this. Hey guys, just want to take a second away from the show to tell you a little bit about DollarBlazeClub.com. That's right, DollarBlazeClub.com is offering our listeners a 25% discount on their amazing products right now. You're looking at pre-rolled cones, lighters, stickers. They have some amazing reviews on Leafly.com. It is a legit thing. Get your 25% off discount through this show alone. It is the highest discount you can get for this product. Go to DollarBlazeClub.com right now and use promo code STAYWOKE for 25% off. And always be ready to blaze. That's promo code STAYWOKE. And now, back to our show. Now, of course, I'd like to introduce the reason that I wanted to make this an episode and talk about this specific guy. And it's because his crimes are so very intriguing. And the fact that the reason they're intriguing is because of what he did after he killed somebody, as well as the fact that the man is massive. Absolutely huge. Just a large, large guy. And we're talking about a man who stands like a giant amongst other serial killers. And that's not only because of the crimes that he committed, but also because he is a very large man. His name is Edmund Kemper III. Edmund Emil Kemper III, to be specific. He was born in Burbank, California. So perhaps he was actually just born in that area and didn't live in that area. That just makes you curious about what his parents could have possibly been doing if they were actually living right there. I would imagine that's probably where the hospital was located. But he was born there December 18, 1948. He was the middle child and only son, born to Clarnell. What the fuck kind of name is that? Clarnell. I don't like it. I don't like it, but this is obviously way, way back in the 1920s when she was born. Clarnell Elizabeth Kemper. Like, why would you not have been Elizabeth first? Anyways, and Edmund Emil Kemper II. Seems right. I mean, obviously. Emil II was a World War II veteran who, after the war, tested nuclear weapons in the Pacific Proving Grounds before returning to California. And when he came back to California, he proceeded to work as an electrician. So how crazy, though. Dad was testing nuclear weapons and was a World War II veteran. What a tough dude, it seems like, right? Seems like he'd have to be a pretty tough guy to be doing these type of things. Clarnell actually often complained about Edmund II's menial electrician job and later said, and it's quoted, "Suicide missions in wartime and atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with her." Whoa, that's dark. That's dark. Like I said, tough guy working hard jobs, and then he's got to come home and deal with Clarnell. You know, I don't want to deal with Clarnell on her bad days. What is she like if this is a good day, right? Clarnell affected him and quoted to say more than 396 days and nights of fighting on more than 396 days and nights of fighting on the front did. So he's comparing how awful she was to how, I guess you'd say, lethargic the fighting was. He's joking. I mean, he might not be joking, actually, when you think about it. He's probably being 100% serious, but he's trying to be subtle, I guess. Weighing 13 pounds, Edmund Kemper was born. He was already a head taller than his peers by the age of 4. He was highly intelligent, but exhibited behavior such as cruelty to animals. And at the age of 10, he actually went on to bury a pet cat alive. Once it finally died, he decides to dig it up and then decapitates it and mounts its head on a spike. And this is something that he becomes fascinated with, the head on a spike. And it's really strange because I don't know, there's often talks about the McDonald Triad, and that is where these three specific character traits come into play that kind of point to the idea of a serial killer. Most serial killers will have these three traits. And they've added some things and taken some things away, but in most cases it is cruelty to animals, pyromania of any kind, you know, an obsession with fire, and then wedding to bed. So where do you get the stabbing a cat's head, putting a dead cat's head on a stick? It's crazy. Dead animals in general, not fun to look at. Anything dead, I would say, right? Kemper later stated that he derived pleasure from successfully lying to his family about killing the cat. So the fact that he knew that he killed the cat and the fact that he was getting away with lying about it gave him pleasure. Like, what a sick individual. Just already. By the age of 13, he had killed another family cat when he perceived it to be favoring his younger sister more than him. And he kept pieces of it in his closet until his mother found them. That's probably because mom was going in there and still cleaning his room. I wish that was a thing in my house. I was the only one cleaning my room. I'm sure, like most of us, I was the one having to clean my room every damn. Like, I was the, come on. Like, let it be. That was always the argument was like, hey, I have to live in there. If I wanted to be filthy, I should be able to have it filthy. Like, why are my mom's friends coming over and going and checking if my room's clean? Doesn't make sense. But of course, after this, Kemper had continued to create more of a dark fantasy life. He proceeded to perform rituals with his younger sister's dolls that culminated in him removing their heads and hands. And on one specific occasion when his elder sister, Susan, teased him about all of this and asked why he did not try to kiss his teacher, he replied, "If I kiss her, I'd have to kill her first." What? You say that to your sister? I mean, of course you can be, you know, pulling punches a little bit, but that is dark to be that young and have that kind of ominous thoughts already. To say a quote like, "If I kiss her, I'd have to kill her first." How do you get there? How do you get there? You know, what movie were you watching, Mr. Kemper, that brought you to that, you know, quote, I guess you'd say? He also recalled that as a young boy, he would sneak out of his house and, armed with his father's bayonet, go to a second grade teacher's house to watch her through the windows. He stated in later interviews, because this man talked, he stated that some of his favorite games to play as a child were gas chamber and electric chair. Like, where do you come up with those games? I played, like, house and school. I feel like hopefully most of us are the same. But in which, after mentioning these games actually consisted of tying... He asked his younger sister to tie him up, flip an imaginary switch, and then he would tumble over and writhe on... He would be the one... pretending to be the victim in these situations. He also had a near-death experience as a child. Once, his elder sister tried to push him in front of a train. So good people all around. And another, when she successfully pushed him into the deep end of a swimming pool, where he almost drowned. So these are not fucking... his sisters don't even seem like nice people. I mean... It just seems, I get sibling rivalry. I have the same thing with my sisters, but I've never had a situation where even though I was twice their size, they were trying to push me in front of a train or push me in the pool. I mean, if they did, they weren't nearly as successful as, you know, these guys ended up being, the fact that he almost drowned, but... That experience in itself, because I did almost drown as a kid, and it is not fun. Especially when there's somebody right there next to you who could easily save you, but they just sit there and kind of laugh hysterically. Like, what are you doing? Just push me forward, and guess what? I'm out of the area where I'm drowning. But Kemper actually had a close relationship with his father, and was devastated when his parents separated in the year of 1957... So he was not very old. They caused him to be raised by Clarnell in Helena, Montana. He had a severely dysfunctional relationship with his mother, who was an erratic, domineering alcoholic, who frequently belittled, humiliated, and abused him. Clarnell, what a fucking dumb name, often made her son sleep in a locked basement because she feared that he would harm his sisters. Regularly mocked him for his large size. At this point, he was standing 6'4". He was only 15. And she derided him as a real weirdo. That's terrible to hear coming from your mother. She described her... She also refused, to coddle him for the fear that she would turn him gay... And told the young Kemper that he reminded her of his father, and that no woman would ever love him. That's quoted. Kemper later described her as a sick, angry woman, and has been postulated that she suffered from borderline personality disorder. Now, continuing on at the age of 15, Kemper finally ran away from home, as a lot of them did. You know, kids, I would say, not just people, but kids were running away. Maybe not more back then, maybe the same, but running away nonetheless. He ran away to reconcile with his father in Van Nuys, California. Once there, he learned that his father had remarried and had a stepson. Kemper stayed with his father for a short time, though, while until the elder Kemper sent him to live with his paternal grandparents. So, tried to stay with mom, ended up running away because she's awful, tries to reconcile with dad, but dad has a new family, so dad decides to pawn him off on the grandparents. They happen to live in a mountainous ranch in North Fork. That's kind of hard to say. North Fork. Okay. Kemper hated living in North Fork. He described his grandfather as senile and said that his grandmother was constantly emasculating him and his grandfather, which is a terrible thing. Now, I was talking on another show recently, not this show specifically, but I was talking recently about, you know, angry old women. Angry old women are domineering. You've seen them. They exist, and you know which ones I'm talking about. But that's exactly what this woman was. She was that woman that always wore a wig. Her husband had to drive, even though his legs barely worked. But she was the driving force of their relationship. And you could just see that she was angry. She looked angry. But yeah, that's what this woman was. That's what she was. And Kemper couldn't catch a break. No matter where he went, somebody was making fun of him for the way that he looked. His height. I mean, the man had a crazy, crazy IQ. He was very smart. Very smart. Let's get into his first touches with crimes. Keep in mind here, Ed Kemper is still a very young dude. Just a teenager, really. 15, 16. So on the night of August 27th, 1964, Kemper's grandmother, Maud Matilda Huey Kemper, was sitting at the kitchen table when she and Kemper had an argument. Now, enraged by this argument, Kemper stormed off and grabbed a rifle that his grandfather had given him for hunting. You don't keep guns in the house if you got it crazy. He then returned to the kitchen and fatally shot his grandmother in the head before firing twice more into her back. Some accounts mention that she also suffered multiple post-mortem stab wounds with a kitchen knife. When Kemper's grandfather, Edmund, finally returned from grocery shopping, Kemper went outside and fatally shot him in the driveway. He was unsure of what to do next, so he phoned his mother. She did urge him to call the local police. Kemper then called the police and waited for them to take him into custody. When he was questioned by the authorities, Kemper said that, and it's quoted, that he just wanted to see what it felt like to kill Grandma. And that he killed his grandfather so that he would not have to find out that his wife was dead. Psychiatrist Donald Lund, who interviewed Kemper at a length during adulthood, wrote that with these murders, in his way, he had avenged the rejection of both his father and his mother. Kemper's crimes were deemed incomprehensible for a 15-year-old to commit. A court psychiatrist diagnosed him as a paranoid schizophrenic before sending him to the criminally insane unit of the Atascadero State Hospital. It's a strange name. So he kills his grandparents, shoots his grandparents, just to see what it felt like. What a weird, weird thing. I mean, obviously it feels like, yes, very, very strange. And when I think about my grandparents, and just like most of us, you probably think the same way I do, like, almost better than your parents. Usually better than your parents. They give you better gifts, they give you money, they're always super sweet. And it's always a thing because they know that they don't have to take you home. They don't live with you. They get to get away from the kids. But the parents have to deal with it now. So it's kind of weird that he would even think that killing his... I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to kill your grandparents. It just feels like, you know, they took him in at the end when nobody else would. And here he is, taking their lives, and then sitting there and just waiting for the cops to take him away. So at the Atascadero, California Youth Center, authorities, you know, psychiatrists, and social workers strongly disagree with the court psychiatrist's diagnosis. Their report stated that Kemper showed no flight of ideas, no interference with thought, no expression of delusions or hallucinations, and no evidence of bizarre thinking. They recorded his IQ at this time as 136. He was re-diagnosed and stated as having personality trait disturbances, of the passive-aggressive type. Later on, in his time at Atascadero, that's fucking kind of hard to say, Kemper tested a high Q higher than 136 and ended with 145. Genius level, folks. Kemper endeared himself to the psychiatrist by being a model prisoner and was trained to administer psychiatric tests to other inmates. One of the psychiatrists later stated he was a very good worker, and that's not typical of a sociopath. He really took pride in his work. Kemper also became a member of the JCs while in the psychiatric hospital, and stated that he developed some new tests and some new scales on the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, specifically an overt hostility scale, during his work with the psychiatrist. After his second arrest, Kemper stated that being able to understand how these tests function allowed him to manipulate his psychiatrist, and admitted that he learned a lot from the sex offenders to whom he administered the test. For example, they told him it was best to kill a woman after raping her to avoid leaving witnesses. What? Like, that's just some really, really dark advice to give somebody who is relatively still young. Because by the time he's actually released of the year 1969, in December, he's only 21. Kemper was released on parole against the recommendation of the psychiatrist at the hospital. He was released to the care of Clarnell. And Clarnell had remarried and taken the surname Strandberg, then divorced again. She lived a short way from where she worked as an administrative assistant at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Kemper later demonstrated further to a psychiatrist that he was rehabilitated. And on November 29, 1972, his juvenile records were permanently expunged. The last report from his probation psychiatrist read, damn, what a dummy. If I were to see this patient without having any history available or getting any history from him, I would think we were dealing with a well-adjusted man who had an initiative, intelligence, and who was free of any psychiatric illness. It is, to my opinion, he has made a very excellent response to the years of treatment and rehabilitation, and I would see no psychiatric reason to consider him to be of any danger to himself or any member of society. And, since it may allow him more freedom as an adult to develop his potential, I would consider it reasonable to have a permanent expunction, never even seen that word, of his juvenile records. So these guys were, you know, highly, highly fighting for him. Highly fighting for him to do well, thinking that he was going to do well. And it just makes you wonder, with that level of IQ, was he smart enough to play the system to that level? Was he smart enough to play the system to that level? I believe so. I truly believe so. He was a monstrous dude, though. While staying with his mother, Kemper attended community college. As part of his parole requirements, he had hoped he would become a police officer. Terrifying. Sounds like Charles Manson? No. Who? There's somebody else that wanted to be a cop as well. Oh, BTK. So this is probably before, I don't know, who cares. Either way, he was rejected because of his size, so he couldn't get in because he was too big. Seems crazy. But at this point, Kemper was standing at 6'9". It led him to the nickname Big Ed. Kemper maintained a relationship with Santa Cruz police officers despite his rejection because he's a monster of a man. Of course you gotta pay attention to him. You should be, at least. I mean, I'd befriend him. You gotta have a big guy on the team. That's all I'm saying. He hung out at a bar called the Jury Room. It was a popular hangout for law enforcement officers as well. He worked a series of menial jobs before securing employment with the State of California Highway Department, now known as the California Department of Transportation. During this time, his relationship with Clarnell remained toxic and hostile, with mother and son having frequent arguments, which their neighbors often overheard. Now, it's got to be crazy to see his mother, who I'd imagine was very much half his size, screaming at him. Kemper later described the arguments he had with his mother around this time, stating, "My mother and I started right in on a horrendous battles, just horrible battles, violent and vicious. I've never been in such vicious verbal battles with anyone. It would go to fists with a man. But this was my mother, and I couldn't stand the thought of my mother and I doing these things. She insisted on it, and just over stupid things. I remember one roof raiser was over whether I should have my teeth cleaned." That is bizarre. But Henry Lee Lucas did kill his mother over an argument pertaining to him taking care of her in her old age. She wasn't even old yet, but when she got there, how ridiculous. When he had saved enough money, though, Kemper moved out to live with a friend, Alameda. Here, he still complained about being unable to get away from his mother, as she regularly phoned him and paid him surprise visits. That'd be annoying. He often had financial difficulties, which resulted in him frequently returning to his mother's apartment in Aptos. The same year he began working for the highway department, Kemper began dating a 16-year-old Turlock High School student to whom he would later become engaged. Also during this year, he was hit by a car while riding a motorcycle that he had recently purchased. Imagine hitting a 6'9" dude. Your car is ruined. His arm was badly injured, and he received a $15,000 settlement in a civil suit he filed against the car's driver. While driving around in a 1969 Ford Galaxy, he bought with the settlement money, of course, he noticed a large number of young women hitchhiking. He began storing plastic bags, knives, blankets, and handcuffs in his car. He then began picking up the girls and peacefully letting them go. According to Kemper, he picked up around 150 such hitchhikers before he felt homicidal sexual urges, which he called little zapples, and began acting on them. We're going to get more in-depth with what this man is doing. After being born in Burbank, California, moving away, coming back to Van Nuys, California, here we are. Still talking about Ed Kemper. Hey guys, just want to take a minute away from the show to tell you a little bit about my friends, PodCoin. That's PodCoin. I know you guys enjoy listening to podcasts, otherwise you would have never heard this ad. So if you would like to get paid to listen to podcasts, download the PodCoin app today. You will find every single podcast you can think of on PodCoin, and you can listen to it and get paid. And then you can take that money, donate it to charity, get an Amazon gift card. So many options, so many reasons to go download the PodCoin app right now. It is available on all iOS and Android devices. So get that PodCoin app today and get paid to listen. Use code Seamus for 300 PodCoin at sign up. And now, back to the show. Between the years of 1972 and 1973, Kemper embarked on a murder spree that started with two college students and ended with the murders of his mother and her best friend. He would pick up these female students who were hitchhiking and take them to isolated areas where he would shoot, stab, smother, or strangle them. He would then take their lifeless bodies back to his home, where he would decapitate, perform iramushio on the severed heads, whatever that is. I believe that's where you have sex with the severed head. Sexual intercourse with their corpses, and then dismembered them. During this 11-month spree, he killed 5 college students, 1 high school student, his mother, and his mother's best friend. Kemper has stated in interviews that he would often go hunting for victims, usually after his mother's outburst towards him, and that she would not introduce him to women attending the university where she worked. He recalled, she would say, "You're just like your father. You don't deserve to get to know them." Psychiatrists and Kemper himself have espoused the belief that the young women were surrogates for the ultimate target, his mother, and that the humiliating acts he committed on his mother's corpse support this hypothesis. Now, some specific victims here, Mary Ann Pesci and Anita Lucchese. On May 7, 1972, Kemper was driving in Berkeley, California, where he picked up 2 18-year-old hitchhiking Fresno State students, Mary Ann and Anita. It was on the pretext of taking them to Stanford. After driving for an hour, he managed to reach a secluded wooded area near Alameda, which he was familiar with from his work at the highway department. Now, these two girls had no idea that he changed direction. Now, here he intended to rape them, but having learned from the serial rapists at the psychiatric hospital to not leave witnesses, he instead handcuffed them and locked them in a trunk. Then he stabbed and strangled Pesci to death before killing Lucchese in a similar manner. Kemper later confessed that while handcuffing Pesci, he brushed the back of his hand against one of her breasts, and it embarrassed him, before adding that he even said, "Whoops, I'm sorry," or something like that after grabbing her breast, despite murdering her minutes later. Fucking dark, man. Kemper then put both of the women's bodies in the trunk of his Ford Galaxy and returned to his apartment. He was stopped on the way by police officers for having a broken taillight, but the officer did not detect the corpses in his car. Like, Jesus, are you kidding me? Kemper's roommate was not at home, so he took the bodies into his apartment, where he took photographs of and had sexual intercourse with the naked corpses before dismembering them. He then put the body parts into plastic bags, which he later abandoned near Loma, I don't know, probably to Mountain. Before disposing of Pesci's severed, the two girls' severed heads in a ravine, Kemper engaged in that arumotio with both of them. In August, Pesci's skull was found at the mountain, and an extensive search failed to turn up the rest of Pesci's remains or a trace of Lucchese. The victim list just goes on and on. And my biggest thing is the mother's killing, because to kill your own mother is just insanity. And my whole thing with it is, this guy, he was so fascinating when I saw somebody portraying him on the show Mindhunters on Netflix, and he did such a great job. And there are real interviews from Ed Kemper on YouTube if you guys are that into that type of thing, and I've watched him before, and it's chilling. It's 100% chilling that the guy was very, very smart, and he is still alive today. But the whole reason I became interested with him as an American criminal, I guess you'd say, is specifically because he's a massive guy, and he went through and killed all of these women. And he specifically killed most of his own family. So not only is he in prison for the rest of his life, but he doesn't even have family that's coming to visit him in any fashion. But continuing on, April 20th, 1973, after coming home from a party, 52-year-old Clarnell Elizabeth Strandberg, which is his mother, awakened her son with her arrival. While sitting in her bedroom reading a book, she noticed Kemper enter her room and said to him, "I suppose you're going to want to sit up all night and talk now." Kemper replied, "No, good night." He then waited for her to fall asleep and returned to bludgeon her with a claw hammer, then slit her throat with a knife. He subsequently decapitated her and engaged in that Arumashio thing with her severed head. Using it as a dartboard, Kemper stated that he put her head on a shelf and screamed at it for an hour, threw darts at it, and ultimately smashed her face in. He also cut out her tongue and larynx and put them in a garbage disposal. However, the garbage disposal could not break down the tough vocal cords and ejected the tissue back into the sink. It seemed appropriate, Kemper later said, as much as she'd bitched and screamed and yelled at me over so many years. Kemper then hid his mother's corpse in a closet and went out to drink. Upon his return, he invited his mother's best friend, 59-year-old Sarah Taylor, over to the house for dinner and a movie. When Hallett arrived, Kemper strangled her to death, decapitated her, and spent the night with her exanimate body. He subsequently put her corpse in a closet, obscured any outward signs of a disturbance, and left a note to the police, simply reading, "Approximately 5:15 a.m. Saturday, no need for her to suffer any more at the hands of this horrible, murderous butcher. It was quick, asleep, the way I wanted it, not sloppy and incomplete, gents, just a lack of time. I got things to do." Kemper then left the scene, driving nonstop to Pueblo, Colorado. After not hearing any news on the radio about the murders of his mother and her friend, when he arrived at Pueblo, he found a phone booth and called the police. He confessed to the murders of both his mom and her friend, but the police did not take his call seriously and told him to call back at a later time. What a bunch of idiots, right? Several hours later, Kemper called again, asking to speak to an officer he personally knew. Kemper then confessed to that officer of killing his mother and Hallett, which was the friend, and waited for the police to arrive to take him into custody, sort of the same way he probably did when he shot his grandparents. The police finally arrived, take him into custody, where he also confessed of murdering 6 students. Now, when he was asked why he turned himself in, Kemper simply said the original purpose was gone. It wasn't serving any physical or real or emotional purpose. It was just a pure waste of time. Emotionally, I couldn't handle it much longer. Toward the end there, I started feeling the folly of the whole damn thing. And at the point of near exhaustion, near collapse, I just said to hell with it and called it all off. The hell? So in the end, just like with his grandparents, which was the beginning, he simply just let them say, you know, let him be taken in. Come get me. I'm through. In the California Medical Facility, Kemper was incarcerated in the same prison block as other notorious criminals such as Herbert Mullen and Charles Manson. So the man is still locked up, as I mentioned before. Charles Manson is no longer alive, but Ed Kemper has been in the same facility as these two guys, as well as some others, I'm sure. Kemper showed particular disdain for Mullen, who committed his murders at the same time in Santa Cruz as Kemper. He described Mullen as just a cold-blooded killer, killing everybody he saw for no good reason. Kemper manipulated and physically intimidated Mullen, who at 5'7" was more than a foot shorter than he. Kemper stated that Mullen had a habit of singing, and bothering people when somebody tried to watch TV, so he threw water at him to shut him up. Then when he was a good boy, he'd give him peanuts. Herbie liked peanuts. That was effective, because pretty soon he asked permission to sing. That's called behavior modification treatment, and these are all things that Kemper was saying about this guy here. He looks crazy, though. If you look at a picture of Ed Kemper right now, currently locked up, it's almost unbelievable that that's him, and they haven't had another photo of him since 2011. So, you know, it's been 8 years since we've seen anything like him, or any photo of him. Kemper does remain among the general population in prison and is considered a model prisoner. He was in charge of scheduling other inmates' appointments with psychiatrists and was an accomplished craftsman of ceramic cups. He also read a bunch of books and did receive a rule violation, though, in 2016 for failing to provide a urine sample. So he's probably doing those drugs in there. As I said, the man still lives And it is just so crazy because when it comes to all of the serial killers that have ever existed, he killed most of his family. When it comes to the 10 victims that he claimed, you know, three of those were bloodline. They were family, people he knew, people he grew up with, but also people that didn't treat him very well. But like I said, out of all the serial killers, this man was a monster. A huge, giant man. And that is scarier than when you look at a Jeffrey Dahmer or a Charles Manson. Those guys look so small. Just imagine their brains. And their interest and vices, I guess, or obsessions in a body twice that size. The things they would have got away with. This guy was doing just insane things. And two different times, I would say he was nearly normal. Living a regular life where he wasn't killing anyone. So it is possible. No matter how small the window. To get somebody to go in another direction and possibly not become a crazy killer. But here we are nonetheless. All right, guys, that is our show. I want to thank everyone again for listening. You guys are everything to the show. It just means so much, man. It really, really does that you guys take to the show at all. I put in a lot of work on this thing. That's why it takes me a little bit longer to get episodes out for this. But nonetheless, I keep working. Keep working, keep pushing forward, and keep trying to give you guys an entertaining product. Something interesting enough to say to you, I'm going to do my own research. I'm going to look into this myself. I'm going to go watch those ridiculous YouTube videos with this guy's confessions, I guess you'd say. I don't know what else you'd call him. It's fucking weird. But listen to him talk. He's got 145 IQ. At least it's interviews with him from many, many years ago. But I've always wondered what it'd be like to see these guys together, how they feel about each other. Put these two, you know, put like Glenn Rogers, who is still alive, put him together with Ed Kemper and see if they have a conversation or if they blatantly disgust each other. Very curious. As I said, you guys can now follow this podcast on social media. Good over there at Crimes American. Tell me how you feel about the show. Help support, retweet, you know, say positive things. Anything helps. Don't forget to donate to the show at patreon.com/Seamus, the host. All donations welcome, man. You guys could be superheroes, executive producers, and you would get a huge shout out on this show by simply making a donation. You can do it there at patreon.com/Seamus, the host, or go over to paypal.me/chewed and make a one-time donation there. Anything helps, man. It goes to getting me more mic stands, better mics, mixers, all of these great things that make a better product for you guys. So you helping me is me helping you, and we all get entertained in the same, right? Just because I love this just as much as you guys do. True crime, fantastic. I love it. Don't forget to listen to the show on Podcoin and get paid to do so. Tell all your friends, use code Seamus. All of those things. What else? Plenty more coming, you know. I'm coming in hot. Don't forget to stay, you know, stay in touch. Stay in touch is what we do. I'm trying to cut back on the you knows. I'm doing everything I can. I think there was maybe 15 in this episode. Don't count them. Please don't. That would suck. But thanks for listening, guys. As always, I'm Patrick Michael, and this has been American Crimes. Good night. I'm going to go to the hospital.